hilarity will ensue for the second season of Funny You Should Mention, debuting both in this here channel on The Gist and as its own feed on Funny You Should Mention. Funny You Should Mention Season 2 features my conversations with such comedians as Rosebud Baker, Michelle Buteau, Alex Edelman, TJ Miller, where we sit down and I ask them, do you really believe that? Is that why you said it? Is it the funniest way to say it? Is it the truest way to say it? Sometimes we describe it as unpacking the profundities and punchlines. Yeah, I know that's alliterative, but what I'm trying to get at is comedians are like the modern philosophers of our time. So I ask them about their philosophy. Funny You Should Mention, like I said, has its own feed. Subscribing there will give you bonus materials and make sure you never miss an episode or every other week in The Gist, starting on April 4th. It's Friday, March 28th, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today, Donald Trump was asked to define a woman. I think he did a good job. He said, she's the one lying about me so viciously, but also Ivanka. No, he said, childbearing members of the species. And then he added, usually smarter than men. Good political instinct. Got a laugh from the endocrinologist community. And then he added a grace note.
Hey, I watched a congressman, a well-known Democrat congressman, fighting for the fact that men should be allowed to compete essentially in women's sports. And I say, I hope they keep that going because they'll never win another election. That's a big deal. But women are basically incredible people, do so much for our country, and we love our women.
Well, that's sweet and rare. Donald Trump, big tough guy. Expressions of love don't come easy, but actually, they do. Just Wednesday, in announcing tariffs, Trump veered into love on a statewide level.
Indiana, the great state of Indiana. I love Indiana.
Same remarks. Then he went national. A nation was given his or our love.
Made in Ireland. Ireland was very smart. We love Ireland.
He also loves certain car companies that he can't correctly pronounce.
I love Tesla.
And a basketball coach. And for this one, he provided a reason.
By the way, I love Bobby Knight because he endorsed me.
Checks out with the whole Indiana thing. Donald Trump, man of love. Especially EV-driving Irish-American female Hoosiers. Yes, Emily O'Hanlon of Terre Haute, Indiana. Donald Trump has a gigantic boner aimed directly at you. I hope there are enough charging stations between you and the Canadian border to make your escape. Nah, I'm kidding. I'm just kidding. It's not gigantic. On the show today, a spiel about the Turkish Tufts student and what she actually said or wrote to get snatched up by federal agents. But first, more with Scott Payne, former FBI agent. He is the author of Codename Pale Horse, How I Went Undercover to Expose America's Nazis. Indeed, he did not just expose, but bring charges against members of The Base, a neo-Nazi hate group. I should also mention that CBC has spun out a series called White Hot Hate, Agent Pale Horse. It's really good, not least of all because, as you will hear and maybe have heard yesterday, Scott Payne has the gift not just of infiltration and Harley riding, but gab. Scott Payne up next. We're joined once more, as we were yesterday, by Scott Payne, former FBI agent, author of Codename Pale Horse, How I Went Undercover to Expose America's Nazis. And the first question today, or the first couple of questions, are about this specific case and about the FBI policy in general. But first, I got to know, did you see the movie Hitman, directed by Richard Linklater?
Based off the video game Hitman?
No, it's based on the real story, you know, somewhat changed for the screen. Glenn Powell stars in it. Anyway, there's one point where they assert, and it's interesting, and it is based on a real story, a guy who was a college professor but was really good at pretending to be a hitman, and New Orleans law enforcement used him in that role. But they also make the case that there really is no such thing as a hitman. People think you could hire a hitman because of Hollywood movies, but that's not how it worked. And I said, that's wrong. Not just in the mafia. There are many, many actual hitmen. That's why people go out and hire hitmen. It's not just a myth, but is it a myth?
No. I mean, but in my experiences with all the murder for hires kind of cases that I was privy to, that whole $300,000 for a hit, that is very rare.
It's like 20 grand, maybe?
Yeah, and less. Yeah. Because a lot of times it's like, hey, I want this person killed. I don't have any money yet, but when you kill them, I got a $90,000, insurance plan. But you got to give me something. I mean, I need something. I'm not going to go. I mean, what kind of a business person would I be? I'm like, all right, let me go kill these three people based on your word from somebody I don't know. Now you're going to need to give me something. And that may be a truck title. It may be a diamond ring until, the job's done and you get your money and then I get my money.
But you in the FBI, you busted people looking to hire hitmen, but you also busted hitmen, right? I mean, the Justice Department and local, state, and law enforcement do arrest actual hitmen who do the job. Okay. So were you, and from what I understand, reading the book, listening to podcasts, these are called cameos. When you just do a quick role as a hitman, you're not under deep cover. Are you basing your character on what they think a hitman's like, or the actual hitmen that the actual FBI and law enforcement have actually arrested?
When I did it, I tried to base it on true facts. You're hiring me. This is what we're going to do. We're going to meet. What do you want? How do you want it to look? Accident, no accident, doesn't matter. Disappear, doesn't matter. What do you got to put up front for it? Don't be calling my personal phone, which is really my undercover phone, but we're going to have a means of communication that's supposedly untraceable. And then when the job's done, those phones get smashed, kind of thing.
Tell me about the base. And give me the time frame and how'd you get involved with these guys?
So the base, as I say in the book, a lot of people hear white supremacy, even in law enforcement, they hear white supremacy, they think hoods and robes and cross lightings and everybody says burning, cross burning, but it was the
Klan. Right, they call it, they will tell you it's not a cross burning, it's not a cross lighting, burning. So everyone can see the cross.
Yeah, that's not a cross burning, that'd be sacrilegious. We're not burning the cross, we're lighting the cross. And I'm like, oh, that makes perfectly good sense. Not really, but okay. So the base is one of these newer, or was one of these newer accelerationist groups. The ideology for acceleration was really started around in the 80s. There's a movie, I don't know if it's out yet, called The Order. It's based on a group like that. They didn't call it accelerationism then, but it's kind of like that survivalist militia meets white supremacy, preparing for D-Day. So that you got that doomsday prepper kind of thing going with the ideology, essentially ending in an ethnostate.
We're going to set off a race war. And this goes back a long time. Day of the Rope, Turner Diaries.
Yes.
Even Charles Manson, obviously crazy, but adjudicated not to be, but believed in this sort of stuff.
Nice guy.
That was what Helter Skelter was.
I know, right? Is that a swastika on your forehead?
He's really committed to the bit.
I'm just saying, and it's not a good tattoo either. It just looks like you drew it. I mean, anyway.
And I don't know. It doesn't help with the parole board. I mean,
you could cover it up with something. You could turn that in anything you wanted to. You just got to pack enough ink on your forehead. But so the accelerationist movement is, I'm glad you mentioned Charles Manson, because there's a book called Siege, and it was written by James Mason. James Mason's a longtime white supremacist out in Colorado. He created Adam Waffen. Adam Waffen was a big name within the last several years of an accelerationist group. And then the base was, I don't want to say a spinoff of that, but it was another accelerationist group. And the base was almost more like an umbrella accelerationist group. And what I mean by that is everybody that I met in the base when I infiltrated it was a member of another white supremacy group. There was Adam Waffen members in the base. But their ideology is a little bit different than you've seen in neo-Nazis in the past, where neo-Nazis in the past, like Aryan Nations and stuff like that, they'll take the Bible, the story of the Garden of Eden, and they just wickedly twist it to match their ideology. And that was called Christian identity. But accelerationism is this. Accelerationism, they call it siege culture because it's that book Siege, which James Mason wrote. And in there, he interviews and talks with and about Charles Manson a lot, kind of idolizes him. And there's some Satanism type stuff in there as well. They call it siege culture, but accelerationism is this. They don't believe that there is a political solution to save the white race. They believe that society is going to collapse either on its own or from man-made events, and they want to speed up that collapse, hence accelerate. And they don't. They kind of go against the grain of your Charlottesville, or you're out there standing on the corner waving your signs, yelling racial slurs. Number one, they say it does nothing. Number two, you're making yourself a target. And they look at more like guerrilla warfare type tactics, which would be a power grid over here goes down, a train derails over here, water systems poisoned over here, anti-fascist or leftist or non-white person gets murdered over here, businesses get set on fire, that kind of stuff. And in an attempt to set off what they referred to when I was in, they referred to it as the Boogaloo, which would be like D-Day, which is the racial war. And it always ends, like I said, not the entire United States, but like in the base, the groups I was in, we were looking at the Appalachian Mountains as setting up somewhere in the Appalachian Mountains, setting up an ethno state. Another part of the base was looking at the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And another group of the base had land in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. So we know white supremacists murder people. We know white supremacists, lone wolf types, Dylann Roof will go into a church and kill black people. There are many, many other examples that aren't as notable. We know they're dangerous in many ways, and often they're involved in other illegal activity. But do they actually have plausible, credible plans to attack a train depot, take down the power grid, that sort of attack on infrastructure, as opposed to just one-off killings of massive amounts of people or large amounts of people, which can be done? So that is my question. How plausible is it to worry that they're going to take out a power grid?
Well, that's what we're trying to find out. That's why we're being proactive in law enforcement and going in there. We can't just go in and investigate on a whim. That's wrong. You can't do that. We have to have some type of predication. You have to document whether it's, I interviewed you and you said, hey, Scott, I met this guy, or he's in this chat group I'm in, and he's saying he wants to shoot up a synagogue. Well, that's good intel for us. Maybe now we can open a case, and we go and try to figure out whether through sources or through just good old law enforcement investigation, or an undercover, go in there and try to find out what are you? I mean, I've been in groups that were neo-Nazis and white supremacists. And I'm talking like for 5 months, I read every post in this Telegram group we were in. I would go to sleep for 6 hours, wake up and be over 1,000 posts behind. And I didn't miss a single one for 5 months because I was trying to learn. I'm also a case agent, and I'm anal in that way. I didn't want to miss anything. I didn't want it to be on my watch. But after 5 months and meeting up with these guys, it was clear that they were just spewing a bunch of hate, but they didn't have the means to do anything. They weren't going to try to do anything. They were literally just training and waiting for the day itself. And then if something kicks off, then maybe they would do something. And that's not against the law.
Right. So what happens then to the investigation?
Well, being the undercover, I'm not running the case, so I don't really have so much of a say-so. If it was my case, I would have a say-so, but it's going to be up to that agent, maybe their management, maybe the United States Attorney's Office. Personally, when I've done things like that, like I had a case on somebody that was a well-known white supremacist for a year and a half, following this guy around. And I mean, other than doing some malicious damage and carving a swastika into a door, it really wasn't nothing that was going to meet a federal level. And,
right.
And
you always heard he was armed, which would be illegal as a felon, and you or someone would pull him over and he never was armed.
Some like that. Some like that. But the one I was talking about that I followed for a year and a half, that guy, I ended up approaching him. I mean, I did it not out in the public, and I'm like, hey, here's the deal. I've been following you. I know that you are part of this. I know that you've been doing this, but I don't see that you're doing anything illegal. And I was wondering if maybe if you ever see anything nefarious or innocent people are going to be hurt, would you be willing to tell me about it? And then essentially I'm still building relationships, right? I'm still connecting with people. I'm just doing it overtly as Scott Payne, the FBI agent.
Right. And these are how in many types of law enforcement, confidential informant CIs are built, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It does strike me that, and you have infiltrated the Klan, but it does strike me that since it's not illegal to be a racist or even to be a member of the Klan, the portions of the Klan, I guess, that don't have explicit threats, that it would seem likely to me that the members of the Klan who aren't actually actively trying to overthrow the government would work with law enforcement a lot. Does that happen?
Yeah. I guess it's going to be a case-by-case basis, but you bring up a good point that I try to make when we're putting on training or teaching or whatever. Even if it's a brand new agent, you're trying to train them up. I'm like, when I'm talking to you about going out and developing sources, I'm not talking about, from my world, I'm not talking about you show up in a suit and tie and it's a high-ranking member of upper societal, you know, echelon Fortune 500 company, whatever, and you meet them for a cup of coffee and you say, Mike, I heard that you worked at this place. I sure would like it if you would give the FBI some information. And you go, well, you know what, Scott, that sounds, I'm not talking about right. that. I'm talking about you go into somebody who a lot of people would refer to as a piece of S, right? A POS. And that person has hated law enforcement their entire life from personal experiences, from their family experiences, but after sitting down with you for an hour or whatever, they walk away saying things like, you know, for a cop, you're not that bad. Or, I didn't know there were cops like you. That right. kind of thing. And I'm not talking about the traditional where we got a charge over your head going, well, if you want to work this off, I mean, you got to picture being an undercover and say you're the source. And you and I are going to be hanging out now, living a life kind of together, and you're my lifeline. If I'm out there holding this over your head going, you better do it or we're going to charge you with this, that's not the kind of trust level I want when I'm undercover with you, because you could get pissed in the middle of that field in the middle of nowhere and say, you know what, screw this, Scott's an FBI agent. That's not what you want.
Yes, you want them to decide to do it, not to feel forced or compelled to do it. It's going to be much more fruitful for your purposes.
Yeah. Yep. Still gaining that trust. It's a dating game.
And also you are making in many cases the rational case to them. It is in your self-interest to do this, right?
Of course.
You can start getting looked at for illegal things that you didn't do. But if you tip us off to illegal things you hear happening around you, you know, you're going to be able to protect yourself and your family. That sort of argument.
Yes. Yeah. Do the right thing. I mean, if you break...
Do the right thing within the context of being, you know, a Klansman.
That's a good point. Not like the Klan right thing. I'm just saying.
Be the best right Klansman thing you could be, but not as defined by the Klan.
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of these interviews for the book coming out. But it's the thing is I tell people, like, look, left or right, we can go into all kinds of stuff. If you're far left, I think you're not a smart person. If you're far right, I know you're not a smart person. I've been with them. You know, just come towards the middle a little bit. It's okay for you to like something I don't and vice versa. But if you break things down into good versus evil, generally speaking, most people, human beings, know the difference between good and evil. There are those who can't tell the difference, and there's terminology for them. But if we just break it down, is this good or is this evil? Mm-hmm. For me, it makes it more of a black and white issue. Pardon the pun.
So I want to know about the base. Give me the time frame. How did they react with what you described as the Charlottesville rally, where they probably looked down on it as antithetical to their goals? So what was going on then? And, you know, what was the danger they represented?
Well, first of all, in the accelerationist movement belief system, they refer to the mass murderers as saints. So you've already said Dylann Roof. Generally, when we're out, especially teaching tactics and active shooter stuff, we never mention the bad person's name because that's kind of what they wanted. But for this context, we're talking about the undercover, kind of need to say the name, but they'll say is Saint Roof Day, and that's the day he murdered those people. It's Saint Tarrant Day, Saint Brevik Day, Saint Bowers Day, and they've got a saints list. They've got a score list of who's killed the most, who's murdered the most, 77-0, whatever, 9-0, and what are you going to do to make the board? Yeah. So That's some very
Tarrant, the New Zealand shooter, Bowers, the Tree of Life shooter, Brevik, the Scandinavian, Norwegian shooter. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I'm sorry. Yeah. Tarrant was Christchurch. Brevik was, I think Brevik has the most numbers. I have the,
yeah,
I have the slide
island.
In one of my PowerPoints. Oh my God. Yeah. But, the accelerationist, what we found with the base was this. I get in, you start gaining trust, you start learning the ideology, and we're out doing all kinds of training, firearms, tactics, hand-to-hand combat, living off the land, how to make weapons, stuff like that. And they're training. And we're talking about, some of them are just kids, and they don't have a car, they don't have a job, but they've got an arsenal in their closet. The plate carriers they were wearing was the same plate carrier system that the FBI SWAT team wore. I literally could have taken my FBI rig, my plate carrier belt and all that, and just taken the FBI stuff off and walked right in, and it would have been good kit. So you see that, and we started uncovering murder plots and plots where they wanted to go off and incite a race war. And once you get those, especially when we get to the point to where they've already picked this one cup, the cell that I was in, C-E-L-L, I got a country accent, but the cell that I was in North Georgia was already looking at murdering a couple who they believe were Antifa members. They had already started building a list of left journalists and reporters to start taking out and killing. The other group that was up towards the Maryland area, they really were buying into this. There was going to be a huge gun rights rally in Virginia, and because the governor at the time was pretty liberal and anti-gun, and there was going to be a big rally supporting the Second Amendment, and their idea was, what if we kick this? What if this is the kickoff to the collapse of society? A couple of bullets start flying. There's hundreds of thousands of people. Nobody knows who's shooting at who. Everybody starts shooting everybody else. And then they come in and kind of clean up.
Yeah. And do you think you paint the picture in the book about the couple in North Georgia, the supposed Antifa couple? Do you think but for your involvement, they'd have gone through with it and killed those people?
Yeah, sure. I mean, because I went out with them and the place was being canvassed. The weapon with the silencer was already made. Catch bags were already purchased for the AR-15s, which is you attach it to the machine gun in case you have to use it, submachine gun. In case you have to use it, that way when the brass ejects out of the rifle, that bag catches it so you don't leave anything, any kind of evidence behind. I mean, the planning was very detailed to the point of we're going to show up at a campsite. We're going to leave all our electronics, anything there. We're going to leave the campsite. We're going to go to a pay-by-the-hour motel. We're going to scrub ourselves to get any kind of flaky skin washed off, completely wrap ourselves up, tape the gloves to our shirts, tape our pants to our boots, Vaseline over your hair, even to the point to where one of the guys kind of heading the thing had done research that some people, when they kill somebody for the first time, lose control of their bowels. So he was going to get Depends for everybody to wear. So I would say that's a lot of overt acts in furtherance of a killing. And if I, the FBI, the case teams wouldn't have been there, some bad stuff would have happened.
Yeah. Just a note, Scott declined the Depends, even under cover.
I did. I declined them. I didn't say I killed people before, but that let them know that I probably did.
Yeah. Don't worry. I know I don't need the pens.
I'm pretty sure I don't need those.
His name is Scott Payne. The name of the book is Codename Pale Horse, How I Went Undercover to Expose America's Nazis. And he co-wrote it with Michelle Shepard, who hosts the CBC podcast, Agent Pale Horse, which is season 2 of White Hot Hate. It's a really good podcast, a really good book, and I really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much, buddy.
And now the spiel. A Turkish student studying at Tufts University in Boston was snatched up by immigration and detained. There's some sound from the surveillance video of that. She is clearly shocked. Initially, the video of this detention spread around and caused concern, caused outrage. And while it seems scary for the frightened young woman to be beset by plainclothes police and spirited away to who knows where, an immigration detention facility as it turns out, it doesn't tell us anything about the underlying nature of the offense. So I wanted to find out what she did. Because there is a case to be made, and the administration is making it, against Columbia student Mahmoud Khalil, that he is offering some measure of support for a terrorist organization. Let's table how strong the case against Khalil is. I have talked about it. He is affiliated with organizations who have excused and even supported the actions of Hamas. Okay, that is one person. In this case, we have an entirely different person. Her name is Rumeysa Ozturk. Asked about the detention of Ozturk, Secretary of State Marco Rubio laid out the case against her.
It's an F-1 visa, I believe. We revoked it, and here's why. And I'll say it again. I said it everywhere. Let me be abundantly clear, okay? If you go apply for a visa right now, anywhere in the world, let me just send this message out. If you apply for a visa to enter the United States and be a student, and you tell us that the reason why you're coming to the United States is not just because you want to write op-eds, but because you want to participate in movements that are involved in doing things like vandalizing universities, harassing students, taking over buildings, creating a ruckus, we're not going to give you a visa. If you lie to us and get a visa and then enter the United States and with that visa participate in that sort of activity, we're going to take away your visa. And once you've lost your visa, you're no longer legally in the United States.
Okay. If you're going to vandalize universities, harass students, take over buildings, create a ruckus, your visa might be in jeopardy. Get that? Ozturk didn't do any of that. But listen to what Rubio said more carefully. If you're going to participate in movements that are involved in doing things like vandalizing, harassing, etc., you're open to deportation. Now, there's a lot of subjective interpretation to participating in movements and involved in those things. I mean, does participating in a movement mean that you agree with every one of the points made by other actors in that movement? It seems like a stretch, but in this case, that's not even what we're talking about. If there were video of Ozturk standing alongside protesters who occupied a lawn against campus rules, that'd be one thing. If she were refusing to disperse, that'd be one thing. If she were helping the people who occupied a building on campus or negotiating on behalf of the occupiers, which is what Khalil did, I'd say, you know, you're probably participating in a movement. Doesn't mean that you deserve deportation, but I can understand why that phrase might apply. This isn't what happened in this case. That's not what she did. Now, maybe some more information will come out about what she did, but as of this reporting, there is one act linking her directly to harassing, vandalizing, occupying protesters. And it's not direct. It's very indirect. It's an op-ed in Tufts Daily newspaper. She's one of four signatories to it. I've read a few such letters over the last few years, some op-eds, letters to the editors sent to college newspapers, and a lot of them pretty much border on the shameful. QAD, the Columbia organization that Khalil participated in, has publicly expressed horrible opinions, specifically offering support for a student who said that we should be grateful that he didn't go out and murder Zionists. But Ozturk, her op-ed didn't say that, didn't say anything like that. It's a pretty boring, mostly pro forma, procedural objection to the university not agreeing with a resolution passed by the Student Senate. Yeah, your blood is already churning over those phrases, right? Here is the only part that could possibly consider specifics about supporting Hamas. You'll see what a stretch it is. Quote, these resolutions, those Student Senate resolutions, were the product of meaningful debate by the Senate and represent a sincere effort to hold Israel accountable for clear violations of international law. Credible accusations against Israel include accounts of deliberate starvation and indiscriminate slaughter of Palestinian civilians and plausible genocide. Now, I, Mike Pesca here, ending the quote, do not believe Israel committed clear violations of international law. Well, there is some body of international law about the settlers in the West Bank, where most people, most signatories to that law would say, yes, of course, they have violated the law. But the thing about international law is you need the specific countries to sign on to it. And Israel never did, and the United States, in the case of, say, the ICC, never did. So that's important. Anyway, like I said, it's a fairly pro forma statement of international sentiment. And it doesn't in any way support Hamas. And the rest of it, to go over every single phrase, I, Mike Pasca, do not think that Israel deliberately starved the Palestinians. But the op-ed doesn't technically even allege that. It has two qualifiers in between Israel starved Gazans. It says there are credible accusations that include accounts of starvation. Sidney McCain made one of those accusations. I think Sidney McCain is wrong, but she gets to stay in this country. And not just because she's a citizen and the wife of a former senator, but because there's really nothing actionable about that belief. As to the credible accusations of plausible genocide or slaughter, again, I don't think they're credible. I don't think it's plausible, but reasonable people can disagree. Plenty do. You can read some very fair-minded reporting about the situation with food or how indiscriminate versus proportional bombing is. I happen to think that that is an incorrect way to describe what's going on in Israel. I disagree with it. I'd have not voted for those student resolutions. But there is nothing in there about Hamas or the goals of Hamas or the actions of Hamas. There's nothing inconsistent with the sentiment that what Hamas did was terrible, but the Israelis have gone too far in response. The idea should not get you deported, even if you're on a visa, even if you said it on the way to getting a visa, even if during your application process, they were processing you and said, hey, how do you think Israel's acting in response to the attacks of October 7th? And you said, a little too far. Unless something else surfaces, this seems to me to be a wild overreach, far worse than Mahmoud Khalil. In fact, I've been waiting for something else beside the op-ed to surface. This can't be it. Even in the face of Trumpist extremism, this can't be the basis for what Marco Rubio is asserting, that this person's words or beliefs contradict U.S. foreign policy. I know that the Trump administration is taking great glee in the fuck around and find out stance towards anti-Israel protesters, but this woman ain't it. Not Raimisa Ozturk. Not for that op-ed and only that op-ed. The thing they think they're warning those who fuck around, warning those who engage in pro-Hamas sentiment, that is not in evidence here. The thing they really are fucking with are something like any vestige of free speech or free thought, or any kind of civil liberties in America, which is what America has always stood for. That is what I think they are fucking with. Have they gone too far? I think so. We'll need a little bit of time to find out. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Umpru-ji-pru-du-pru. Thanks for listening.